Okay. Good. All right. So good evening and welcome back. I trust your Sukkot was beautiful, meaningful, weird, inspiring, all things rolled into one. Tolerable, not too cold, hopefully not too rainy, and so on. We have some dedications actually for the class today. With gifts from the Day of Giving that we held in July. So Morty Shapiro, Cindy Schorser, and Susan and Murray Silverman. So thank you. So we are in chapter 16, the end of Shimshon's career. We may actually get beyond that to an introduction to chapter 17 as well. I will note for you what I said before we started the recording, which is that that with my new system of sending out the email, and we'll hopefully get all the kinks worked out of it in terms of making sure we have the right email address for everybody and so on. But when you see the link that says the source sheet is here, it's linking to a file in my Google Drive. In order to be able to print it, you have to click on the link, you get the file open, download it and save it, and then open it to print it. That's the way that it works. But you need to save it to your computer in order to be able to print it. I apologize for the extra step for you. On the other hand, there's also an extra step for me in terms of uploading it to the Google Drive in order to be able to do it, all in the name of being able to get the email to everybody because the current system was bouncing from too many people. So this is apparently the wave of the future. So again, we are towards the end of Perek Tet Zayin of chapter 16. And just a little review of chapter 16. I'm not going to go back through the review of Shimshon's career. That we've, thank God, done quite a few times. But just starting from the beginning of the chapter, we had his journey to Aza, in which he met a Zona. We said that a Zona may be an innkeeper, but more likely, as the commentators note, it's somebody else who fits the pattern of Shimshon's involvement with the Plishtim, the woman that he married in the beginning of the story, and Delilah, who we've been learning about more recently. And the people find out that Shimshon is there. It just says they were told that Shimshon was there, and they lie in wait in ambush outside of the city gates. Shimshon wakes up in the middle of the night and goes out and lifts the city gate on his shoulders and carries it off to either the hillside facing Hebron or to Hebron itself. And of course, we wondered as we read the story, what do you mean? Shimshon woke up in the middle of the night and just, you know, went out to the ambush. What exactly is going on that, you know, Shimshon could have just woken up in the middle of the night and realized that he was under attack? Not to mention, once again, how did they know he was there? And that led us to suggest the idea, Malbim says it, that actually what happened was Shimshon was the one who told them he was there. And this whole story in Aza was Shimshon looking for trouble. He is confident that he can deal with whatever comes his way. Maybe he's a little bored, nothing to do that weekend. He's a Jet fan, they're 0-6. And he says, you know what? I'm going to go to Aza instead. It's time for me to go do something else for entertainment. And so he goes to Aza, unclear. I mean, obviously I'm joking about the entertainment part, just to be clear. Shimshon is doing this presumably as his ongoing war against the Plishtim. But after that story, we find out that he meets Delilah, and boy, does he love Delilah. And we were really impressed because love is a big deal. And he doesn't marry her, but he falls in love with her. He moves in with her, and Delilah gets Shimshon to tell her how to weaken him. And this story demonstrates the wickedness of the Plishti women. Again, that contrast with Shimshon's mother, Hatzlel Ponit. It also demonstrates Shimshon's overconfidence, because every time he tells her how to weaken him, and then he gets up and he throws it off, and he clearly thinks he can overcome anything, so that when he tells her the truth, that this is all about his hair and cut his hair and he will be weak, he still gets up after his hair is cut and says, I'm going to go attack them once again. He thinks that Hashem is going to be on his side no matter what. But it doesn't work that way, right? Hashem abandons him and he is weak. and he suffers a measure-for-measure punishment for going after the Plishti women. The Plishtim put out his eyes, which we noted was parallel to his statement that she is good in my eyes. He always followed his eyes, as the Gemara in Sota noted. Questions and comments on what we just reviewed from the first part, or first few parts of the Perek? Okay, then let's pick up from there. Pasuk Chaf Beis, sentence 22. Vayachal Sa'ar Rosho Litzameach Kasher Gulach. Shimshon is at work in the prison, and his hair starts to grow after having been cut. And I think we mentioned when we read this sentence last time, I think I just led with or ended with that last time, there's a sort of ominous tone to that. The you know, you can sort of hear the two sort of you know, bass type notes there on the piano. Dun, dun, his hair is growing. But one of the questions we're going to have is how much does that matter, the growth of his hair? So keep that in mind as we read the story. Pasuk Chaf Gimel, sentence 23. V'sarnei filishtim ne'esfu lizboach zevach gadol ledagon Eloheihem ulesimcha. The leaders of the Plishtim gathered to bring a great sacrifice to their god Dagon and for simcha, for celebration. They have a big celebration planned. Vayomru, and they said, Nasan Elokeinu bia or Eloheinu biadenu es Shimshon oyavenu. Our God has given him into our hands. We are so thrilled that he is now ours. Vayiru oso ha'am, and the nation saw him. Vayhalalu es Eloheihem, and they praised their God. Kiyamru, they said, Nasan Eloheinu biyadenu es oyavenu, our God has given our enemy into our hands. Ve'ez machariv artzenu, the one who destroyed our land, right? Not only our enemy, but he remembered the whole thing with the foxes. He destroyed our land. Va'asher hirba'as chalaleinu, he increased our corpses. Now he is ours, and they rejoice. Parenthetically, we don't know how long this is after Shimshon was captured, right? That's not clear. The question that I have here is, why did you wait so long for this party? Long enough that his hair is growing. What were you waiting for in holding this party now, David?
Maybe they were still afraid that somehow his magic powers are not gone. Maybe it's just a temporary thing.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Maybe it was immediate. Maybe Hashem simply advanced the rate of growth of hair. Maybe it was the next day or two.
So maybe his hair actually grew back extra quick. So the truth of the matter is, there is such an argument to be made. If you take a look back at the word that's used when it starts to grow in sentence Chaf Beis, you find a very interesting thing grammatically. What's the verb that's used to describe the growth of the hair?
Litzameach,
right? Litzameach. What word should it have been?
Litzmoach.
Litzmoach. So Malbim, we'll see, is going to seize on that and say, Litzameach suggests something powerful. It's not just it's growing, but it's growing fast. In the same way that we say, and I'm not going to go into a whole grammar lesson here, but we say shavar means he broke, shiber means he smashed. It's a stronger term. We're not doing kal and pl and all those other fun things. But those who are having flashbacks to, you know, grade school and high school. But that's Malbim's suggestion, in fact, is it grew back extra fast, and maybe that's true. Abarbanel doesn't think so. We're going to find out when we introduce chapter 17 that Abarbanel thinks that Shimshon is in jail for a very long time. And a whole bunch of stuff happens while he's in jail. All the events that we're going to read in chapters 17 through 21, Abarbanel thinks happened while Shimshon was in jail. So he doesn't accept that. It seems to me that within his view, the answer may well be that this festival celebration wasn't about Shimshon. If you go back to the text, it looks more like the nation was doing a sacrifice for their god, Dagon. And in their festival, they said, well, what has Dagon done for us? Dagon gave us Shimshon. And now let's celebrate. Sorry. Let's celebrate what Dagon has done for us. He gave us our enemy. But it's really not a Shimshon festival. It's really a Dagon festival. That may be the answer here. And the other way to explain it. In any case, they make their big party. They have the Sranim come. This is a big celebration. All the political bigwigs are in town. And they're really happy that they've got Shimshon captured. And that brings us to Pasuk Chav Hei, sentence 25. Vayi ki tov libam, when their heart was good. What does that mean, when their heart was good?
Often it implies drinking.
Yeah, like from where?
Esther? Ketov Levam Bayayin?
From Megillat Esther. Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin. Right? When Achashverosh decides, hey, wouldn't it be a great thing to bring my wife out to the party? Right? Tov, in this case, is Lev HaMelech. The heart of the king was good, Bayayin, with wine. They had had something to drink, and they start to feel good. Vayomru, and they said, Kir'u l'Shimshon v'yisachek lanu. Call Shimshon, and he is going to do something ridiculous for us. Doesn't say what it's going to be, something that will make us laugh. Vayikru l'Shimshon mi'beit ha'asurim. They call Shimshon out of the prison. They summon him. Vayitzachek lifnehem. And he did whatever funny thing it was in front of them. Doesn't say what his trick was. It was something that he did that made them laugh. Ve'amidu oso bein ha'amudim, and they stood him between the pillars. The pillars, of course, we know the story, that support the building. Question for you, and this is something I referred to in addressing a question by Howie some time back. Does Shimshon seem like the sort of fellow who you tell him, ha, we've got you at our mercy, do something to make us laugh, and he does it? That's not really the Shimshon we know and love. Shimshon seems like the sort of guy who you say to him, you know, dance, and like, you know, he punches you. Like, he's not, yeah, he doesn't particularly care about what's coming next. He's not dancing. So what's going on? Why is Shimshon dancing now? So Professor Eli Tzur in the Dat Mikra gives you what is clearly the answer to what's going on here, building on this sentence and the next sentence. So let's take a look back at the next sentence first. Vayomer Shimshon el hanar hamachazik biyado. Shimshon says to the youth who's holding his hand, Hanicha osi. He says, leave me and let me feel the pillars that this building is established on. And I'm going to lean on them. He says, you know, I need to take a rest. I know you have support pillars. Let me lean on the pillars. So says Professor Eli Tzur in source number one on your sheet, combining what we just saw about Shimshon playing along with their game, and the fact that Shimshon is able to make this request here, he says, Shimshon nene lahem b'simcha uberatzon. Shimshon listened to them. He went along with it, happily, willingly. Sha'az kosher ha'isalozad. This was his opportunity. V'nirisha Shimshon haya makiras habayis od milifnechein. Shimshon knows the building. That's how he knows where the pillars are. That's why he's going along with it. Shimshon sees that he has a chance. Because again, this, I'm going to keep on reiterating it because it's so core to the story. Is Shimshon strong now? Does he have his strength yet? No, he does not have his strength.
We think not.
No, we know he doesn't. It's coming through in the rest of the story that he still doesn't have his strength. But he's still plotting. Shimshon is ever the optimist. He's going to get himself in position to be able to do what he wants to do, and God will take care of it. That's Shimshon's philosophy. So take a look at what happens. V'abayis malei ha'anashim v'hanashim. The house is filled with men and women. V'shama kol sarnei plishtim. And all the plishti officers, the leaders of the five cities, they're there. V'al hagag, and on the roof. Kishloshes alafim ish v'isha haroim b'schok Shimshon. Like 3,000 men and women watching what's happening with Shimshon. Parenthetically, as you read the sentence, you realize there are two different ways to read how many plishtim there were, right? How could you read this sentence? I read it one way, but you could just as easily read it a different way.
It could be 3,000 men and one woman, or three, right? Ve'isha?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about reading it that way.
No, I thought maybe a special woman, maybe Delilah or something.
That's an interesting idea that I have not seen. But what could you do?
Are there 3,000 on the roof?
Good.
More elsewhere.
It's all where you put the comma. Uh-huh. Either read it as the house was filled with men and women and all the plishti officers and on the roof. All told, there were 3,000, which is the way I read it. Or put the comma where the esnachta is in the pasuk, the laning pause. And therefore, the house was filled with men and women and all the plishti officers. And on the roof, there were 3,000 men and women. Just on the roof, there were 3,000, which is the way the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah actually reads it. You have many, many more. It's not just 3,000. It's actually way more than 3,000 present on in the building altogether. So you have the 3,000 on the roof plus, or you have 3,000 in the building. Either way, Shimshon is good to go. He got himself in position. He went along with the prank. He's letting them play him because he is playing them. And then he makes his pitch. Pasuk Chavcha, sentence 28. Vayikra Shimshon el Hashem vayomar. Shimshon called out to God and he said, and by the way, I have a note in the margin. At some previous point when I learned this story of Shimshon, I counted the number of attacks he has against his enemies. And according to the count that I had, this is number 7. I haven't recounted it now to see, really, but that would be very interesting because the number 7 is so important in his story. The 7 locks of hair, the 7 is a significant number. In any case, he says, Hashem Elokim, Zochreinina, he says, Hashem, the powerful God, remember me, please. I'm assuming that na is please rather than now, but the truth is you can read it either way. V'chazkeni na, and strengthen me, please. Ach hapam hazeho Elokim, just this time, God. I have one last request. V'inokama nekam achas mishisei einai, Mipalishtim, and I will get revenge for one of my eyes from the Plishtim. So Shimshon is weak. And again, this goes back to what we said before. Shimshon manipulates himself into this situation, plays along in everything when he has no strength, all because he trusts that this is going to work out, that this is actually going to bear fruit. And he says to God, remember me, strengthen me just this once, and I'm going to get revenge for one of my eyes from the Plishtim. Tell me something. What is it that Shimshon wants God to remember about him? What does that mean, remember me? Remember my dalliance with Delilah?
No, the way I was, the strength you gave me, the way you helped me before.
Remember the strength that I had. Maybe.
Remember the way you helped me before.
The way we were a team, God. You gave me strength and I beat people up. Right? It's not remember my mistakes. It's remember the good times we had, so to speak. The Gemara in Sota says something different. Take a look at source number two. This is really perplexing. Gemara says, Amar Shimshon lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shimshon says to Hashem, Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Zechor li Esrim Shana Sheshafatti Es Yisrael. Remember my 20 years as a judge. V'lo amarti l'achad me'em ha'aver li makel mimakom l'makom. I never so much as said to somebody, carry my staff from one place to another. Now, you're Shimshon, you didn't need to. You could have carried the staff, and you could have carried the person who you had asked to carry the staff. Nonetheless, he's saying, I never made use of anybody in all my years as a shofet. That's a really interesting statement. On the one hand, it rings true, because Shimshon really does appear to have been independent of support from the Jews, right? The people from Yehuda came to him, and he turned himself over in order to help them. Like, Shimshon is not relying on anybody. That's for sure true. But where did you get the idea that this is what Shimshon is asking about? What's that? Where would you build on that? How do you see that in the pasuk? So two ideas. One idea depends not on this pasuk, but rather on a pasuk that we've already learned, but it hasn't happened yet. The last pasuk in this chapter, in which we're told Shimshon judged Israel for 20 years. And remember that the first time we were told he judged them for 20 years, we were bothered. Why does it need to say it before? It said at the end of chapter 15, and then say it again at the end of chapter 16. And we gave some approaches, but maybe the Gemara is seizing on that and saying it's reiterated here to say that's why Hashem strengthened him here. That's one possibility. A second possibility, though, the Marsha says, he asks for revenge for his blinded eye. Did Shimshon deserve to be blinded? Did Shimshon deserve this? We said yes.
Yeah, from a religious point of view, yeah, because he used his eyes the way he did.
Right, because he went after his eyes, that's what the Gemara said, therefore he lost his eyes. So the Marsha says, essentially, I'm reading this into the Marsha's words, that there's a response to that idea. You're telling me, Shimshon says, you're telling me that I deserved this? I didn't deserve this. I never took anything from anybody. And remember, Hashochad Yaver Pikhim, the judge who takes a bribe, the judge who takes a payment, is blinded. And Shimshon says, I didn't deserve this. I was an honest shofet. 20 years I've been in the business. I didn't take anything from anybody. And so he says, I didn't deserve it, and therefore I want to get payback from the Plishtim. Don't tell me I deserved it. I did not deserve it. That's the way the Gemara in Sota reads it, as explained by the Marsha.
Then why only one eye? Why doesn't just...
Ah, good. So we're going to come back to that question. I'm not quite ready for it, but it's a very good question. You should have asked for revenge from both eyes. But before we get to that, what about doing it for God? What about the good old-fashioned, you know, help me so that I will be able to win in your name? What's with the revenge thing? So Professor Elitzur, if you look at source number three on the sheet, says, we know him by now. Ish hayitzrim hayashim shon. He is a man of strong drives. Ve'az biyitzrav hayisa she'ifas gimul unakam shiv'atayim. The strongest desire, he says, that Shimshon feels is the desire for payback. Right? We've seen that already. We saw that when the thing happened with his wife. Shimshon insists on paying back the Plishtim. So that may be. It's also possible that Shimshon makes the push this way because he believes a request for his own sake would be more acceptable to God. if Shimshon says, I want to do this for you, maybe Hashem says thanks, but you know, you're done. But now he makes it personal about himself. I don't know. Maybe that somehow relates. But that's his push. He's weak. He has no strength. But he says, Hashem, help me out. And then you get Pasuk Chavtes. Vayilpos Shimshon es Shnei Amudei HaTavech. Vayilpos is a very odd word. Every time I read it, I wonder if it relates to the word from Rus, Vayilafas, in the granary. But Rashi takes it as he grabbed the pillars. Radak reads it as he tilted the pillars. Either way, he grabbed the pillars or he tilted them. Asher bayis nachon aleihem, the ones the house is resting on. Vayisamech aleihem, and he leaned his strength on these pillars. And echad bimino ve'echad bismola, one in his right, one in his left. We get this very dramatic type of description here when you describe how he's holding one in his right, one in his left. What does that remind you of?
Moshe Rabbeinu?
Yeah, the Luchos.
It reminds me, not the Luchos, but the... It reminds you of the war with Amalek, right? The war with Amalek, where Moshe has Aaron v'chur tamchu biyadav mizeh echad u'mizeh echad, right? Moshe's arms being supported one on one side, one on the other side. It's a very dramatic read of this story. Vayomer Shimshon, and Shimshon says the famous words, Tamos nafshi im plishtim. He says he wants to die with the plishtim, or he should die with the plishtim. Vayet b'choach. And he pushes with his strength. Vayipol habayis al asranim ve'al kol am asher bo, comes down on these officers, comes down on everybody inside. Vayu ameisim asher hemis b'moso rabim asher hemis b'chayav, and he takes down more in his death than he did in his lifetime. His greatest attack on the plishtim is actually in his death. In terms of death toll, certainly if you say 3,000, it is just the number on the roof, depending on where we put the comma in that pasuk. But let's pause here before we get to the burial, which we have, you know, let's read the last pasuk also. Fine, we'll read the burial pasuk also. Vayirdu Echav, and his brothers went down. Whoever his brothers were means relatives. I don't know if Manoach and Hatzlaponi, according to what we know, she doesn't have any kids before then, right? She wasn't able to have children. Maybe there were kids born afterwards. I don't know. But relatives of some kind. V'chol beis aviyu, and his entire father's family. V'yis'u oso, and they carried him. V'ya'alu v'yikbru oso bein tzara uvein eshta'ol. They buried him back in the family land between tzara and eshta'ol, where he started. Bekever Manoach Aviv, in the plot of his father Manoach, whether that means his father is already dead or not is unclear to me. Vu Shafadis Yisrael Asrim Shana, and as we said, he judged Israel for 20 years. So, what questions do we have about this section? One we already know, Byron asked, what about the other eye? Why does he only want revenge for one eye? What other questions come up?
How were they able to just go get his body?
Yeah.
They pushed him around. They weren't going to let him come and take the body.
Yeah. Why did the plishtim allow the burial? Good question. What else?
Is this like committing suicide?
Yeah. Is this an act of suicide? You know, the most famous case of suicide in Tanakh is surely the case of Shaul. And there, the commentators all try to justify what Shaul did. No one comments on Shimshon's case. Why not? It certainly sounds like he's taking his life. Plus, yeah, Howie.
Well, the fact that he's blind, he's kemet, and maybe it's not the same thing.
Really? I mean, we would never justify that way.
I was trying to find an answer.
Okay. I would have wanted a commentator to actually ask the question and give that answer if that was really going to be it. Much like with Shaul, you find they ask the question and some say, well, he was going to get killed anyway. He was wounded. He was vulnerable, whatever. I also have the original question that we started this whole thing with, of how long did this take? why is it that they waited so long for this celebration? Because I think that figures into this also, and that's where I want to start.
You read the Matsuda David says...
No reading ahead. That's cheating.
We're just looking at the Matsuda David in the text. I'll die with them, meaning to say... I wish within their death any chavetz be made with him, that I'll die also if necessary.
Yep. So it appears we're going to come to it. First, though, is his hair really the source of his strength based on what we just read?
No.
No. How do you know?
Because he's asking Hashem to make him strong, not to grow his hair.
Not only not to grow his hair is already back. The Pasuk already said his hair was starting to grow. Take a look at source number 4, please. Malbim seems to think the strength really is with the hair, certainly at first read. Malbim writes, regarding the hair growing, and I already pointed this out, Amar bepoel hakaved, it used the strong verb, tzimeach. Or litzameach, I should say. Because his hair grew back unusually quickly. Shim lo king, because if not, if it didn't grow back quickly, why didn't the plishtim give him a haircut from time to time? They knew that his hair was the source of his strength. Must be his hair grew back super fast and they didn't realize it. So Malbim thinks, unlike Abarbanel, this was a very brief period of time. But I don't understand. Once again, if his hair was what restored his strength, then what's the prayer for? So Abarbanel says, I mean, you could, if you wanted to push it, you could say, his hair restored his strength, but he's still davening to Hashem, support me. He's turning to God anyway. You could say that. It's not what the text sounds like. Abarbanel says no. His strength does not return with his hair. Take a look, please, at source number 5. Ve'ein ra'ui shenachshov shehayakach shimshon besaros rosho b'derech tiv'i. He says it would be wrong to think that his strength was somehow a natural result of having hair. V'shalachin sar bisuram, and that's why it left when he lost the hair. V'shav kocho b'chazarasam litzmoach, and then he got his strength back when the hair started to grow again. Aval hayak kocho davar nisi. His strength was function of a miracle. Ba'od she yishmor nezirusa, as long as he kept his nezirus. Right? Like what we saw in previous weeks from Professor Kaufman, right? The idea that what we're trying to show here is an anti-pagan, anti-magic message. The nations around the Jews think that magical totems give you things. And what this story is teaching us is no, the strength doesn't come from the totem. The strength comes from Hashem. But now I have a problem. If Abarbanel is right, right? That the strength doesn't come from the hair. What's wrong with the text?
It never says that Hashem has heard his plea.
Okay. Fair enough. But something else.
There's a whole pasuk dedicated to the growing of the hair.
Right. Why did we need the ominous sentence, pasuk chaf beis? His hair started to grow. Abarbanel, who cares? So his hair started to grow. What did it have to do with anything? So Gerald, for your question, I would answer that Shimshon feels it. He feels the response he has received. He feels the strength returned to him.
But in previous Prakim, it said expressly that Hashem gave him strength and he drew his strength from Hashem.
You're right. It doesn't say Vatitzlach Alav or something like that. It's a fair point. I don't have an answer for it. It's a good point. But I do have an answer for why it mentions the hair growing back. This is a new opportunity for Shimshon to be true to his Nezirus. The hair grows back, and now Shimshon is able to be a Nazir once again. It's not Hey, I have hair. Now I'm strong. It's I have hair. I didn't cut it. I am fulfilling my mitzvah. I'm a Nazir again. Now I can go out and do what Hashem wants me to do. That's the way I read it.
Okay. So can you say that the fact that he gave the hair as the reason and she therefore cut it off, he sort of said, you're taking away my Nazirus, so Hashem leaves.
Yes. That's the way I would read it. That's exactly what I would suggest. So I'm going to come back to the suicide in a moment, but first I wanted to just touch on the burial before coming back to that theme of Shimshon giving up his life. Why did they let the Jews do it? So one answer is going to be fear of Shimshon, believe it or not. We're going to come back to that in Yerushalmi shortly. The Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, though, says something very interesting, tying it into Parshas Vayechi. Take a look at source number 6. When Yaakov gives his blessing to the tribe of Dan, and Shimshon, remember, is from Dan. So Yehi Dan Nachash Alei Derech. Dan should be a snake on the path. Ma Nachash Ze Matsui Bein Hanashim, just as the serpent is found among women, Kach Shimshon ben Manoach Matsui Bein Hanashim. So too Shimshon was. I don't know what he means about the snake being found among women other than in Gan Eden. I don't know. Is there another example that we know of snakes being found among women in Tanakh? I don't know. Offhand, nothing comes to mind. In any case, Kach Shimshon ben Manoach Matsui Bein Hanashim. Ma Hanachash Nesar Bishvua. Kach Shimshon ben Manoach Nesar Bishvua. Just as a serpent is bound by an oath by a snake charmer, so too Shimshon ben Manoach was also bound by the oath. Meaning when the people of Yehuda took an oath, and I skipped his, where he brings the psukim, where they took an oath that they weren't going to harm him. Manachash ze kol kolcho eino ela berosho. Kach Shimshon, just like the snake's power is only in his head, so Shimshon, right? The idea of the hair of the Nazirus. Manachash ze riso mechalchel la'achar misa. And just like this snake, the venom harms after his death, so too he killed all these plishtim, more so in his death than in his life. And then they ask, Va'at Amrit, and yet you say, Va'yurdu echav echav beis aviyu, etc. They buried him. How could it be that he was allowed to be buried? Ele Yaakov avinu bikesh rachmim al hadavar. Yaakov davened to be able, that Shimshon should be able to have a burial. Remember that when you read Yaakov's brachos, right? This is a short form of a much longer discussion. But Yaakov introduces his blessings to his sons by saying, Hikavtsu, gather in, and I'm going to tell you, you should listen to, Esa Shor Yikra Eschem Bacharis Hayamim, what's going to happen to you at the end of days. And then he goes on to give them the brachos that don't really sound like they're about the end of the days. So that's an indication, though, that Yaakov is not speaking about the immediate, but he's speaking about something in the future. And when he gives the bracha to Dan, he says, Lishuascha kivisi Hashem. Hashem, I long for your rescue, for your salvation. So he's asking Hashem to rescue Dan. So that's the Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, is that you're right, the Plishtim would not have allowed it. However, Yaakov davened for it, and therefore Hashem said, okay. Abarbanel has a very interesting counterintuitive take. Abarbanel doesn't generally have nice things to say about the Plishtim. But take a look at source number 7. Vihine, hayam yishavach haplishtim shelo hisolalu ba'ach haremoso. This was a positive act of the Plishtim, a positive aspect, I should say, of the Plishtim, that they did not degrade Shimshon's body after he died. Aval nasnu makom shiasu lo kavod b'moso. He let them honor him in his death. Something that's worth revisiting at the time when Shaul dies in battle, at the hands of the Plishtim. But that's the statement here. And then we reiterate the 20 years. So again, we noted at the end of chapter 15 that the normal place to put the reference to his 20 years is here at the end of chapter 16. And we've already noted that maybe Shimshon made reference to his 20-year career here from the Gemara in Sota. But the Yerushalmi says something interesting in source number 8, which I've already alluded to. Yerushalmi says, Kasav Echad Omer, one text said, Vayishbodes Yisrael Mem Shana. He judged Israel for 40 years. We don't actually have a text that says that Shimshon judged Israel for 40 years. But it means that we have two verses saying he judged for 20 years. And then you have this one saying he judged for Chav Shana for 20 years. Amar Rabbi Acha. Rabbi Acha says, Melamid shayu aplishtim yireyim mimenu Chav Shana la'achar moso kederach shayu yireyim mimenu Chav Shana bechayav. They are worried. They're scared for another 20 years after his death. He was shofet for 20 years in his lifetime, and the plishtim were scared for another 20 years posthumously. And maybe that's why they allowed the burial. They're still scared. Okay. But now let's come back to Shimshon taking his life. What would you have expected Shimshon to ask for here? I know what I would have expected him to ask for here. Why didn't Shimshon ask Hashem to... Sorry?
I'm sorry, for his vision back? To be able to see so he can become strong again?
That would be quite the thing to ask for. He's got no eyes.
Got no eyes, yeah. Yeah.
But why didn't he ask for his life? Why didn't he say, God help me, let me get out of here and I'm going to keep on fighting the good fight? Why does Shimshon not ask to get out alive? That's a question. So I think that we can look at it. First of all, let's take a step back. In terms of whether to categorize this as an act of suicide at all, I would note two possible arguments. One argument comes from Dr. Yael Shemesh in an article I brought you in source number 9. I brought you a piece of it called Hit'abdut Bimikra, Suicide in Tanakh. Look at what Professor Shemesh says. Hit'abduto shel Shimshon hi ha-mikra ha-yachid b'mikra shebo ha-meniya ha-mutzhar li'hit'abdut hu nekama. Shimshon's suicide is the only case in Tanakh in which it's an act of revenge. When he says, again, I want revenge for one of my eyes from the plishtim. Lefize hit abdut einama tara, ela emtsa'i v'totza'at levay shel ritzono shel ha-mitabed la-hamit acherim. This was not Shimshon trying to kill himself. It was a means of executing plishtim. Shimshon b'nigud l'shar mitabdim b'mikra noket tzad drasti ze lo b'shel chashash b'nei ha'asid. Shimshon is taking this drastic step, drasti, for those who didn't catch it in the Hebrew. Shimshon is taking this drastic step, I'm afraid of the future and therefore I'm doing this. That's not what he's doing. He's not Shaul. Ela b'shel zam ha-mechuvan klapei ma sha'olu lulo me'einav be'avar or me'onyo be'avar. Shimshon is angry at what they've done to him and he is lashing out. In other words, this is not a suicide. This is an aggressive act. It's not suicide to die. It's a weapon. That's Professor Shemesh's read. A second possible read is that what he's trying to do here is maybe something positive as Kiddush Hashem, someone suggested when I taught Shoftim once before. But I actually want to offer a third idea, and I recognize that this is unique, but I think it may be right. And I think it has enough of a chance of being right that I'm going to put this out there. I'm not sure Shimshon expected to die. I don't know that Shimshon thought he was going to die. When you go back to the beginning of his story, right, and this is going to sort of encapsulate this Shimshon narrative, Shimshon was chosen with a promise that he would save the Jews. Think of people in Tanakh who have that kind of promise, right? Rivka. She is going to be the one. It's got to be her. God picked her to be Yitzchak's wife. Moshe. right? Moshe is born and the house is filled with light. And Hashem says to him, you're going to be the one to save Israel. Gidon. Hashem says to Gidon, now is the time to act. You are the one who is going to do this. Shaul. Hashem picks Shaul. David. Hashem explicitly picks David. The Navi Yirmiyahu. Another example of it. Hashem says, yeah, before you were even born, I knew you. That gives you, when you have that kind of a statement, God comes to you and says, I picked you. That gives you incredible confidence, number one, in Hashem's support, and number two, in the decisions you make. Think about it. Shimshon says about that first Plishti woman, she's good in my eyes. And we read that and we think to ourselves, how can you think she's good in your eyes? What is that? What kind of justification is that? Your parents are objecting to the relationship. What are you doing? But the answer is, God likes my eyes. So if I think she's good, that means she's good. Shimshon surrenders to Yehuda in order to be able to attack the Plishtim. He's thirsty. God, send me some water, please. He sets up an ambush in Aza, as the Malbim reads it, even if you don't accept that he set it up himself. The very fact that he wakes up in the middle of the night, he's under attack, and instead of fighting back, he takes the city gate and he sticks it on his shoulders. The fact that after he has given up his secret and told her about the hair, he still gets up in the morning thinking that Hashem is going to help him against the Plishtim. In Shimshon's mind, he's the chosen one. Nothing is ever going to go wrong.
My difficulty with that is the last case he just said, because Shimshon did not expect God to leave him. And then the Pasuk says, Now at this point, he knows God has left him.
Right. So I'm going to come to that in just one moment. You're right. But what I want to do first is look back at his tefillah. Look back at his prayer again. He says, remember me now, give me strength now, or please, just this one time, Hashem. Just help me out one more time, and I'm going to get revenge for one of my eyes. And then he does this thing with the pillars, and he said, actually, sorry, before that, where did I jump the pasuk? And then in pasuk lamed, he says, tamos nafshi im plishtim. He says, I am willing to have my soul die with the Plishtim. He's willing. He's ready. Because he understands, and this brings me back to Howie's point, he understands that he's guilty. He acknowledges the guilt. Hashem did leave him once before, and he knows that he's guilty. Take a look at Ralbag in source number 12, answering the question of why he says only one eye. And he didn't ask to get out alive. Why? Says Ralbag, Hu haya ra'oi lekach mitzad hispatuso bedvarim hapchusim ha'ele. He deserved it because he let himself be seduced by the Plishtim. Ulezesh sha'al sha'tamus nafsho im Plishtim lefi shalo haya ra'oi lo az lasos lo nes yoser gadol mizeh. He says, I don't deserve the miracle. I'm not going to ask to get out. But I think he's still anticipating it. And that's why he's willing to accept divine justice and just ask for one eye. The Yerushalmi says he asks for only one eye, saying, let the reward for the other eye come to me in the next world. But look at the Marsha in source number 13. Va'odei Shlomar, you could also say, Lefi Sugyat HaTalmud Shalanu, based on the Bavli, he's punished with his eyes for sinning and rebelling with his eyes. He says, all right, fine. One punishment. Fair, God. But the other one, I want revenge. So Shimshon has to recognize, as Howie said, Hashem did leave him. And he says, all right, fine. So I'm not going to ask you to save my life. I'm not even going to ask you for both eyes. Nonetheless, give me an opportunity again. Shimshon in his mind is never done. There's always more. Hang on one second, Chuck. To me, that's what makes Shimshon's story one of the most tragic and moving in Tanakh. The first time that I taught Shoftim, by the time I hit the end of Perek Tet Zayin, I was crying. This is a saga. Part of that is just he gets more real estate than most people in Tanakh do. How many people in Tanakh whose names are not Avos and Imahos get four chapters about them, right? Counting the one about his birth. It's extremely rare that someone gets this kind of real estate. But look at the potential that he had. Hashem is going to be with him all the way through. And he believes it. He's confident in it. It's all going to go the way it's supposed to go. But he burns through it. Because the reality is there's a limit to the number of chances a person can get. That's what you see here. Chuck, you were going to say?
I think there's a level of Ruach HaKodesh with Shimshon.
Mm-hmm.
When he first came and saw the first woman whose parents said, why don't you find a nice Jewish girl? Tanakh lends testimony to the fact that they didn't know that this was really God's plan.
Right.
Maybe that was the Ruach HaKodesh. And maybe, as it's done many times in Tanakh, where we talk about remember me, there are lots of people who are forgotten or felt forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
They may have slipped, or maybe God's plan for them. But all the Imahot who prayed for children because they couldn't have children, they waited to be remembered. I think there are other, I don't remember exactly, but I think there were other people, other famous people in Tanakh. I think Moshe was one of them when they talk about God remembering. Noach, the Pasuk by Yizkor Elokim et Noach. Noach was a tzaddik in his time. God loved Noach. But there's a time that in our impatience, we think God forgets us. So Shimshon, perhaps, knowing about Noach, knowing about the Imahot, knowing about Moshe, prayed for God to remember him in his suffering. And maybe it wasn't that he thought he was committing suicide. He thought like he was going to war. Remember me. Let me be the tool that you used to kill these Plishtim, which was my whole purpose.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's possible. I mean, going back to your first point, we discussed, why he went after the Plishti women and what he thought he was doing. And that was one view, that he actually believed what I am doing is what Hashem wants me to do. There absolutely was such a concept. The question was, is he really cognizant of that? Is it something underlying? Is he just accidentally falling into the right move? But that's a debated question. So, God willing, next week, we are going to start on what is truly one of the most bizarre stories in Tanakh. The last two stories in Shoftim are first a story with very heavy ironic humor, and that's the story of Pesel Micha, and then just like the tragedy of tragedies, one of the saddest things you'll ever see in Tanakh, the story of Pilegesh Begiva. These are bizarre and remarkable stories. So God willing, we'll pick up with that next week at 7:30. I'm going to try to make sure I have all the addresses right on the new email format that I sent out to make sure that everybody gets the sheet. If you didn't get the sheet and you haven't already discussed